All right. Thank you for joining us and want to get right into this. We have a special guest. I think this is this the third time you've been on with us, Mark?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and he's a Seattle Sun. You weren't born here, though, were you?
No, I lived there from 4 until 16, so all of my formative years. So I still call Seattle home.
Gotcha. So you got out of here before things got kind of wacky. You probably don't keep up on Seattle city politics, but we got some real colorful characters running things here. So it's been a wild ride recently. We're actually thinking about doing government sponsored heroin to our homeless population. And I don't know if it's serious, but this was floated recently because we could ensure the quality of the smack that way, you know. So
right, and you know there is a twisted logic in that if you have fewer people getting really sick with chronic diseases like HEP, then it costs the system less. But you can do that probably with needle exchanges as opposed to actually providing the drugs. And I would actually rather see them put them in, you know, rehab education, but you know, longer conversation. We don't really want to talk about that today,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, no. Anyway, well, I'm sure you're pretty good at pop culture. I'm sure you've seen the movie The Big Lebowski, right?
Which one?
The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, you know, I have to admit, as even though I quote many lines from the movie, I've not ever sat down and watched the whole thing. And I know it's a cult classic. My daughter's seen it like 10 times.
Yeah.
So
okay, so
I should sit down this weekend and watch it over the long weekend.
Yeah, it's worth it. It's hilarious. Anyway, there's a scene in there. John Goodman plays this guy, and
yep.
he's got a real rage problem, and he freaks out on the bowling lanes, and he sits there and goes, you know, this isn't NOM. There are rules here, right?
Exactly.
I found myself, and this happens periodically, but I found myself doing that the other day. While doing some research with a couple of our guys and looking at these markets, and I know we've talked about this before when you're on the show, but I continue to be staggered by how long this incredible valuation goes on. When we started doing the show a little over 2 years ago, I was sounding the alarm bell because I think total market cap to GDP was at like 128. Today we're at 150.
Yep.
You've been at this a lot longer than I have, and you've got a pedigree that, you know, makes mine look very meager in comparison. What do you make of all this? How much longer can this go on?
Look, their famous line, you know, from years and years ago, right after the great crash, was, you know, the markets can behave irrationally longer than the rational investor can remain solvent. And I think that's being, you know, shown to us in spades here. Okay, I just did a big webinar yesterday on this as to we call it the great separation and why now is finally the time to get hedged. And you know, people are interested, they can go to our YouTube channel Around the World with USCO and see that. But the key is that I, like you, back in 15, 16, started sounding the alarm bells, and things were playing out the way both you and I, as we first started talking to each other, you know, about this, as we expected it would, right? You know,
yeah.
PMIs were rolling over. They got down to sub 50. Growth was slowing globally. Profits were rolling over. Things were looking really bleak. And if you remember, your listeners remember, the first 6 weeks of 2016, you know, markets were down 12, 15%. People were panicking and hitting the sell button. And then magically, everything bounced on February 10th, and oil prices went from 26 bucks immediately right back to the low 30s. Stocks started to surge, and by the end of the quarter, by the end of the first quarter, it was back to flat. Now, what was really interesting about that is no one really understood what was happening at the time, but what had happened was China had taken $1 trillion. Now, $1 trillion, even though people throw that term around a lot, is a big, big number. Remember, that's that's $1 every second for 31,710 years. So $1 trillion is a very large number. But they took $1 trillion and they started buying commodity futures. That's why oil prices turned around. They started buying iron ore futures and rebar futures, and they also started buying global stocks. And markets recovered, and suddenly there was this reflexive, and reflexivity is something George Soros talks about, that you don't actually have to have a fundamental improvement for things to fundamentally improve, because what can happen is, as the price of assets started to rise again, people perceived that things were getting better, and therefore they were willing to take more risk, or, you know, banks were willing to extend more credit. And so central banks continued to pour credit into the markets, things turned around, and we had another kind of bounce off the bottom, a BF, you know, TD by the freaking dip, BTFD. And what happened is fundamentals did actually then start to get better. Animal spirits were triggered, and everybody got all excited. And so for the last couple of years, we've seen PMIs recover pretty dramatically. Now they've rolled over again. We saw unemployment continue to spike downward. We saw, you know, profits get this boost from, you know, what I think is one of the most horrible pieces of legislation I've ever seen in my lifetime, what I call tax reform. And that will be, it's funny that we opened talking about government-sponsored heroin. That's exactly what the tax reform bill is. It's government-sponsored heroin, and it'll make everybody feel good for a few minutes. And, you know, earnings peaked in the first quarter. They're going to be lower this quarter in terms of growth rates. They'll be worse in third quarter, be worse in fourth quarter. When we lap it next year in first quarter, it'll be really tough comps. So I think we're going to have the letdown of a junkie. And that's a long-winded way, Zach, of saying that we're on that slow path back down. I think the markets peaked in January, January 26th, to be precise, on a Bradley turn date, no less, for those of you who follow me and my numerology stuff. I believe in cycles and all that good stuff. So I think we're finally at a point where gravity is important again, valuation is important again, and we're going to see things start to pay attention to fundamentals the way you and I, you know, were brought up to think about markets.
Yeah, and so is that line of thinking what's gotten you, or are, I found your quarterly, I think it was your quarterly letter where you talked about the year of the frog, right?
Yep.
Is that whole line of thing? I wanted to get you, I haven't talked to you since that came out, and I wanted to get what it was that you saw that made you sit there and go, okay, people, this is the year of the frog. This is when the water starts to boil. And for those of you just joining us, we're with Mark Yusko, CEO, founder, chief investment officer of Morgan Creek Capital. But anyway, I just wanted to ask you, what was it that you saw changing the landscape? Was it the tax deal? Was it, you know, what was it that made you go, okay, this is it?
Yeah, it's a fantastic point and fantastic question in the sense of, you know, by the Chinese New Year, we are, or by the Chinese Zodiac, we are the year of the dog. Maybe that's why all the dog mascot teams are doing so well this year. but really, I changed that around a little bit in my quarterly letter at the end of the year and talked about, no, it's really the year of the frog. And what that means is, you know, we've all heard the thing about, you know, how do you boil a frog? Well, you can't drop him in scalding hot water because it'll just jump right out. So you got to, you know, have the water be cool, and you put the frogs in, and then you turn it up a little bit by a little bit. And by the time it's so hot that they want to jump out, their muscles are so relaxed that they can't jump out. And that's kind of what's been happening to investors since 2009. You know, the water was as cold as it could get, ice cold, March 9th, you know, very bottom, everybody's panicking, the Dow hits 660, or the S&P hits 666, everybody's freaking out, and the government says, oh, this has got to stop, and Bernanke, you know, actually I know somebody who was with him in the room, you know, he addressed the team, and he said, look, I've looked into the abyss, and we ain't going there. So we're going to do whatever it takes, long before Draghi uttered those famous words, and we're going to fix this. And so, you know, they took a playbook out of the 1930s. You know, people think QE was invented. Now, it wasn't. They used it in the 1930s. to try to stop, you know, the Great Recession from becoming the Great Depression. And then the Fed screwed up in 1937, tried to raise interest rates from those zero levels too fast. And, you know, what was a pretty garden variety recession turned into, you know, the Depression. So the key is they pulled out this ancient playbook that, you know, Bernanke had written his thesis on, and it seemed to work, right? You give morphine, back to the drug thing, you give morphine to the patient who's on death's doorstep, and they start to get better. And then you give them more, and they start to get a little better, and you give them a little more. And so markets were recovering, and people were feeling giddy, and then this whole passive wave starts to take hold. And, you know, we've seen this movie before. You know, we saw it in the 70s, the late 60s, early 70s. We saw it again in the mid 80s. We saw it in the late 90s. When liquidity is abundant, people start to buy passive indices. And why do they do that? Well, it's because passive is no such thing. There's no such thing as passive investing. You know, it's just slow active. And what it is, it's momentum. It's capitalization weighted, so you buy more of things as they go up. Now, it's not as bad as the Dow. The Dow is the dumbest index ever created, right? It's created by a newspaper publisher. It's price-weighted. Think about that. The way you average the stocks in the index is by their price. Absolutely ridiculous and stupid, but you know, the guy was not a mathematician or a financial guy. He was a newspaper publisher, Charles Dow. And so it's not quite that bad, but cap-weighting is equally dumb in the sense that what you're doing is you're buying more of things as they become more expensive. That's the opposite of value investing. But momentum is the greatest strategy in the world when it's working. And then it goes off the cliff and you lose a lot of money. And so that's why the market tends to take the escalator up and the elevator down, is this capitalization weighting obsession that we've created. And why do we have an obsession with cap weighting? Well, it all goes back to the last Tax Reform Act, the Tax Act of 86, which actually had nothing to do with taxes and had everything to do with changing our retirement systems from defined benefit to defined contribution. Now, why did they do that? Oh, well, they'll tell you because we champion free markets and portability and the rights of the employee. BS. It had nothing to do with that. It had to do with channeling money from companies and individuals into the hands of mutual fund companies. The mutual fund companies bought the legislation. They lobbied for the legislation. They paid off the senators and congressmen to get the legislation passed. And all it does is it took money that was going into professional management and defined benefit plans. The companies were allowed to contribute one-third less because now they weren't on the hook for the full benefit. They were only on the hook for the contribution, and they let the market take care of the rest. And then they funnel all the money into mutual funds. Well, the mutual fund companies have gotten super, super rich, and the mutual fund, you know, executives have gotten super, super rich, and the average investor today has $44,000 to retire on. Ain't going to happen.
No.
Right?
No.
It's not going to happen. It's the biggest crime committed against humanity in the United States, I think, in my lifetime. And people who used to rely on a good pension and a good retirement plan are now stuck holding the bag. And, you know, look, I talk about this example all the time. You know, my daughter, when she got her first job, right, she called me and said, hey, Dad, will you help me with my 401k? Now, first of all, my daughter has no business being in charge of her retirement. Not because she's not a wonderful person. She's beautiful. She's brilliant. She's a nurse, actually a pediatric oncology nurse, so she's a saint. But she has no training or interest or time, because she works nights a lot of time, to manage her portfolio. And so what does she do? She defaults to 1 over N, which is what most people do. They put 1 over N, so you got 7 choices. You're 1/7 in each fund. And if there are 4 bond choices, you're 4/7 bonds. If there's 4 equity choices, you're 4/7 equity. That's a bad asset allocation model.
Yeah.
Okay? And I tried to help her a little bit, but I'm not going to pay attention to it day by day. So what she should really have is a professional managing her money in a hybrid structure where it could still be portable, but outsource it to, you know, a professional manager. So we did the best we could. We gave a little bit of it to a tactical allocation fund where we hope they will manage it better for her. And she'll be fine because, you know, she has a great job and her husband has a great job, and they'll be fine. But it's just wrong to put her in that position, or anybody at 26, 28, 35, 45. It's just not your primary job to manage your assets, and people spend no time on it. Hopefully they're listening to you and getting help from a good advisor like you and your team, but they shouldn't do it themselves.
No,
anyway, I don't even think I answered your question, but no, I got to rant on one of my favorite topics.
No, and I that's the goal. I try to get to the rants, and I want to continue on, but we got to take a quick break. And if you're listening, stick with us. We got Mark Yusko with us, the CEO and founder of Morgan Creek Capital, and he's been kind enough to spend some time with us. And stick with us. We'll be right back. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH. All right, welcome back, and we're not going to do a long, drawn-out introduction. We're going to get right back into it. We've got Mark Yusko with us, founder and CIO, CEO, the guy in charge at Morgan Creek Capital. And Mark, want to jump right back into our conversation. And something I was thinking about when you were talking, and I have these conversations a lot with our clients and prospective clients, when we start talking about valuations, they go, well, we don't do market timing. I don't do market timing. And one of the things I wanted to hear you talk a little bit about that, because there's this misconception if we're more exposed to risk or less exposed to risk at times that we're market timing. And what I tried to explain to them is, no, it's not market timing. What it is it's looking at assets that on a traditional basis, right? Everybody goes, well, that's not how something's valued. And I always kind of laugh when they start bringing up other ways to value it, because investing in its very nature is buying future cash flows, hopefully at a discounted price today. And if that's not how we're looking at it, then maybe we won't be wrong tomorrow, but we will be wrong eventually. And trying to differentiate between market timing and managing risk exposure. Can you speak to that a little bit? Because when we talk about market timing or year of the frog, I think people get misconceptions that we're timing markets where we're not really, right? We're looking at them and saying, people, look, this doesn't make any sense.
No, look, the biggest fallacy in investing is that we're not market timing. Every single person who says they're not market timing is guilty of market timing, and in the worst possible way, and here's why. They think they're not market timing because they want to let everything run. Mm. Well, think about that. Every one of us should have a strategic policy. We should have a strategic asset allocation policy from which we derive a great long-term return. And the way to think about that is we know that each asset class has a certain return. And we know that the combination of asset class is going to have a return. But the only way you achieve that return is to constantly rebalance your portfolio back toward those targets. But what everybody does is they let things run. So when stocks are rising and they're going up, and you say, let's rebalance back to our target. They say, no, we don't time the market. Well, you are timing the market. You're timing the market, again, in the worst possible way. You're moving away from your target, which by definition is market timing. If you rebalance back to your target, that is the antithesis of market timing. That is prudent fiduciary management. So to let your assets run away from your target and to say, I need to get every last nickel out of every rise in the market, what happens, and it happens every single time, is you go over the falls. And then you don't get out because you're not paying attention. And then when it starts to go, you say, no, I just got to get back to where I was. Then I'll get out. And then it goes down more. And they say, no, now I have to get back a little more before I get out. And then it gets to the bottom, and people despair, and they sell. And so if you think about it, over the last 20 years, the average stock fund, if you just bought and held the average stock fund, you made 7.5%. If you bought and held the average bond fund, you made 6.5%. You know what the average individual investor made? 3.5%.
Wow.
How can that be? All they had to do is buy stocks and make 7.5. All they had to do is buy bonds and make 6.5. Buy 50-50 and make 7. Okay? That's not what they do. They always market time by trying to chase what's hot, and then they sell when it becomes not, and they chase what has previously been hot. So they are market timing, but again, they're doing the antithesis of what you should do, which is rebalance on a periodic basis, quarterly or annually, back to a strategic target. Whether that be 60-40, 70-30, 80-20, 67-33, it doesn't matter. Okay? What matters is that you have a disciplined process. And most importantly, what the average person should do is they should find a great advisor like you and your team, and they should not be involved in managing their capital. They should be involved in earning their capital, spending their capital, building their capital, investing in themselves, which is the highest return investment any of us can make, and spending no time thinking about their capital, their money. That's why you have advisors. And there's this myth that doing it yourself is better. Well, do you give yourself a haircut? No. I could give myself a haircut. I shouldn't ever give myself a haircut, but I certainly could do it. You know, my dad just had open heart surgery. Should he have done surgery on himself? No. And then I take this analogy a little further. When he walked in the hospital, did he demand the cheapest surgeon? Mm-mm. He wants the best surgeon. And yeah. In what business do we know does the best person not charge the most money? So there's this obsession with low fees. Well, that's not what we want to do in investing. We don't want to minimize fees. We want to maximize returns.
Right.
We want to maximize net returns. And so I would gladly pay someone a high fee if they were more talented and could produce better results. And think about every business, you know, doctor, lawyer, football coach, basketball player, okay? A winning coach doesn't get a fee reduction. He gets a salary increase. The best basketball players don't go down in value when they have a great series like the Golden State Warriors, right? Their contracts go up. And yet in investing, we all obsess about trying to be invested in the lowest fee product. Well, that doesn't make any sense. And that's why, again, the average investor underperforms, not outperforms, because they've been sold a bill of goods. I say they've been Bogleized. And I have nothing against John Bogle. He's a brilliant man. He's built an incredible business, and he's a billionaire, and I'm not. So I have nothing but admiration for him. But I think his message of fees first is just wrong. That's good for him. That's why he's a billionaire, and all of his users are not. Think about that for a second.
Yeah.
Another rant, sorry.
No. I'm trying. I'm a rant enabler. That's the job here.
I love it.
I was laughing about your haircut analogy because I absolutely stole that from you. But it reminded me of a meeting that I had with a prospective client recently, and we looked at his returns over the last 10 years, and then we looked at the returns of our portfolio over the last 10 years. You know, using real returns net of fees. And then, you know, using projections. And not only did we outperform the portfolio, but we did it with about probably half the volatility. And the end result was pretty close. I mean, we had better returns, but, I mean, the volatility was ridiculously lower in what we were doing. And he's just a standard ETF guy. And he kind of looked at me and he goes, well, yeah, but the volatility might have been lower, but we ended up at the exact same place, and I'm not paying you a fee. And I just kind of shook my head and walked away and just went, if you don't understand the value of a lower volatility and still winning in the return game in the end,
I'm laughing because if I don't laugh, I'll cry. Because
right.
The thing is, volatility is all that matters, right? Investing is a game of minimizing losses, right? There are three rules to managing money. Rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, don't lose money. Rule number three, don't forget the first two rules. It's about mitigating volatility. You know, Charlie Ellis wrote about it, you know, winning the loser's game. In tennis, the winner doesn't have more winners. They have fewer unforced errors, right? Just get the ball back to the other side of the net and let your opponent hit it into the net, particularly when you're playing against amateurs, right?
Right.
So they think they can hit winners, and they're writing checks their body can't cash, and, you know, they miss. So same thing as investing. Investing is not about the winning stroke. It's not about the master investment. It's about minimizing losses. It's about being diversified, because here's what low volatility does for you. So I showed this chart yesterday in my presentation. So over the last 30 years, now we're talking a long time, right? Over the last 30 years, hedge funds have delivered the same return as long-only equities. And
wow.
People say, oh, well, see, that proves hedge funds are a bad deal. I'm like, whoa, no. You've gotten the same return, okay, but you've done it with half the volatility. Now, what that means is that the bulk of investors, had they just held a pure hedge fund portfolio over that whole period, would have realized most of those returns because they wouldn't have been shaken out in all of the nasty drops. So when the market dropped 50% in 2008-09, okay, hedge funds were down 20. So instead of selling everything at the bottom, which what most stock investors did, they wouldn't have done that. So what low volatility does, it gives you peace of mind to stay committed to your strategy. And commitment to your strategy is the only way you win over the long term. So this guy saying that I'm not paying you a fee for lower volatility is missing the entire point of investing. That's exactly what you're paying for. You're paying for risk mitigation, risk management, and keeping you on track so that you don't, okay, try to play the winners or try to play the losers game and try to hit that cross-court winner with topspin against the wind and hit the net and lose the match.
I'm gonna steal that one from you as well. What I need to do is set up conference calls in these client meetings where we dial you in. I mean, I'm gonna have.
Oh, I'd love to do it. There's nothing I like better than being that guy from 50 miles away. Because when you tell, when any of us tell somebody we love something, they don't hear it, they don't listen. And when you take someone from 50 miles away, oh, they're an expert. Oh, they must know what they're talking about. Oh, I'll listen to them. And they can say the exact same thing. In fact, most times they're fed the exact lines from the person who invited them. But the key is I love doing it. And I love talking to clients because, again, I'm not there to pitch a product. I'm not there to pitch you or me or anybody else. I'm there to educate.
Right.
And I have two talks I give. One is called Alternative Thinking About Investing, and the other is, Welcome to the Digital Age and the Crypto Economy, which is, where I think the world is headed. And the Alternative Thinking About Investing, all I talk about is this idea of risk mitigation first, okay? Wealth creation comes from risk mitigation. Every client that you or I or anybody else has, they're already rich. That's the whole point. That's why they're the clients.
Right.
So how did they get rich? Getting rich comes from concentration. Every, wealth created around the world comes from concentration. Concentrated stock position, concentrated real estate position, concentrated business ownership. That's how you get rich. Now, they say, what's the secret to creating a small fortune? Start with a large fortune and stay concentrated. Because at some point, okay, you get competed away. The people who owned Cisco in 2000 and watched it go up, or Microsoft in 2000 and watched it go up, said, I'll never sell. Well, now here 18 years later, you probably should have sold. So the key is that diversification keeps you rich. Concentration gets you rich. Diversification keeps you rich. So what I love to do is talk to clients and say, look, your job is to make the money. And then you need to have three buckets, a liquidity bucket to fund your lifestyle, okay, 10 to 15% in very liquid assets that you can spend. Then you're going to have your get-rich bucket. That's 10 to 15%, and that's for the friend's condo deal, the brother-in-law's venture deal. You're going to lose all of that, so keep it small. And then 70 to 80% in the stay-rich bucket. And that's what you give to people like you, the advisor, to take care of. And that needs to have a diversified portfolio that rebalances quarterly or annually, that isn't trying to hit long balls, that plays Ichiro baseball. Hit singles, an occasional double, steal a base, maybe make a mistake once or twice a year and hit a home run. And everybody says, oh, how did he do that? He's so small. Well, because he made a mistake, right? When Ichiro's on, he slaps singles all around everywhere. He outruns ground balls, and he gets on base and scores more runs than anybody else. And the Mariners were great when they had him.
Yep.
So the key is that's the way to win in investing too. It's not about hitting home runs, because if you try to hit home runs, what happens? You lead the league in strikeouts too. And that's not a good way to invest.
Yeah.
So yeah. Another ramble, but I really do love having that communication with clients to say, you focus on making the money and spending the money, and we collectively will focus on diversifying the capital and growing it slowly, because that's how you create large fortunes.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got to take a quick break. And Mark, we'd sit here and talk to you all day. So you feel free to cut us off whenever you got to run. But there, I'd be remiss if we didn't have a quick conversation about China and Bitcoin. Do you have some time? Can we do that?
Yep. Absolutely. Be right back.
All right. So stick with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH. All right. We are back. Thank you for sticking with us. And we are joined by our special guest, Mark Yusko, CEO, CIO, and founder of Morgan Creek Capital, which is a hedge fund. Mark, you guys, speaking of which, you guys are managing, what, between 3 and 4 billion now?
Not quite that big. We're about a billion and a half. And, you know, it's a good business to be in. We do a little bit in hedge funds. We do a little bit in private investing. And literally today, we are closing our first fund focused on blockchain technology. So that's pretty exciting.
You see, man, you're good. So the next thing we wanted to talk to you about was Bitcoin. And I wanted to start kind of from, well, and not just Bitcoin, but blockchain.
Yep.
And wanted to start from kind of the 40,000 foot view here. I remember when Bitcoin was first launched, and it was really intriguing to me because it came online right in the middle of the financial crisis, when, you know, the Fed was going ballistic and I was still trying to figure out what in the world QE was. And I remember sitting there chuckling to myself, thinking, you know, this is really a shot across the bow of central banks and fiat currency. And I didn't understand it nearly as well as I do now. And I still don't understand it as well as I should. And one of the things that's intrigued me about your approach on this is, you know, you are managing, you know, $1.5 billion. You've worked with some of the most, you know, famous and renowned investors in the game. You know, you've swam, and I'm not trying to pump sunshine here, but you've swam and you still do, obviously, in the highest circles in terms of investing. And you're one of the only guys I've heard that is repeatedly, you know, pitched the virtue and the potential of blockchain and Bitcoin specifically, and you've taken a lot of flack for it.
Yep.
and I don't want to name any names here, but some shockingly rude, pointed statements from people that I wouldn't have expected it from. And to your credit, you've remained calm. And it reminds me of something that you talk about a lot, which is a variant perception. What is it? Because I got to tell you, it makes me nervous. I see the potential. I really respect your analysis of it. What is it that they're missing? And I know you're not going to go on a rant about, you know, I'm not trying to goad you into a personal attack. I know you won't take the bait. But what is it that they're missing? And what's, you know, I can't imagine that this has made you popular in some of those circles. You've probably gotten a lot of...
No, look, you're exactly right. I mean, a couple things. One, I had the greatest job in the world, right? I get paid to talk to the smartest people on the planet about investing. I mean, I've been doing this now coming up on 30-some-odd years, and it's amazing. I've talked to, you know, literally the smartest people on the planet, from Cliff Asness at AQR to, names that go on and on and on, from, you know, Julian Robertson to George Soros to Michael Steinhardt to lots of really exciting and fun people. You know, the original guys at Sequoia Capital, Don Valentine and Michael Moritz, you know, founder of, or the first investor in Google. So just been very lucky in my life to run around with some of the most amazing investors on the planet. And what's really interesting is technological innovation engenders these incredible rifts. And so this is not my first rodeo. You know, I remember when I first got into the business, first coming out of school in the 80s, and there was this thing called the personal computer, right? And remember people saying, you know, who would ever put a computer in their home? No one would ever want their own computer. You know, we have these mainframe computers that sit on university campuses and big corporations, and, you know, no one could ever displace IBM. And you know, needless to say, you should have went short IBM and long Microsoft and Intel and Cisco and a bunch of other companies. Dell, you know, I bought my first computer from Michael Dell from his dorm room when he was selling them at University of Texas, a little company that he formed called PCs Limited.
You should have taken him public.
Well, I should have taken him public. What I should have done is should have kept the computer as a keepsake.
Yeah.
But the other funny thing is I learned years later, you know, the only reason I bought it is because he had earned in PC Magazine an Editor's Choice Award. And I didn't learn until years later that the way you got an Editor's Choice Award is you paid the magazine extra advertising dollars.
Oh, that's good.
Like, what a scam that was. Hey, I believed it because it was a legitimate ranking, right? Well, it wasn't legitimate, but I thought it was. But Michael was a genius, and Michael built, you know, great company and is a great investor, and now has a great family office that does great investments, and I know those guys. But my story is there is that, you know, when we started investing in things at the first equity shop that I worked for around personal computing, you know, clients were like ready to fire us. They're like, you know, you need to own IBM, and you know, I don't want to own this Microsoft thing. And look, I remember the first Microsoft office building across from Burgermaster, right on, you know, the right before you get on the bridge.
Oh yeah.
I mean, long before the complex in Redmond and Kirkland and all that stuff. You know, I used to look at that. And I'm like, what is that Microsoft thing? I wonder what that's going to be. I don't know if anyone's seen the picture of the original 10 Microsofties. Would you have given those guys money? Whew, that's a scary picture. Can't believe we all dress like that. But bottom line is, it's not this happening again. 1996, right? Yep. Don Valentine at Sequoia hires this guy, Michael Moritz. He's a cub reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And everyone's like, what does this guy know about investing? Well, he invested in a thing called Yahoo, and then he invested in this thing called Google. And remember, when Google was started, it was not the number one search engine. It was like number 33 or something. And eventually it became ubiquitous, and we actually use it as a verb. So if you invest in these early technological waves, people think you're an idiot. They think you're stupid. And one thing I love about Twitter is it formalizes the labeling. And so when I put something out on Twitter and people personally attack me or say I'm an idiot, then I know I'm on to something. And when everyone agrees with it, I'm like, oh, geez, that's already in the price, so let's move on to the next idea. And so I started writing about and tweeting about blockchain technology and Bitcoin back in 2014. And, you know, Bitcoin prices had fallen from $1,000 to $400. And I write these very long letters. You talked about the year of the frog, and then I wrote one called The Virus is Spreading that's all about blockchain technology. And, you know, back in 14, I wrote this 77-page letter, which people think are too long, but I do it because it's how I think. And I always say, if I can't read what I wrote, how do I know what I think?
And they're good reads. I really enjoy them.
Well, I appreciate that. But I wrote one paragraph out of 77 pages in first quarter 2014, and I had clients call me up and say they were going to fire me because why are you talking about this crazy stuff? You know this is not going to be worth anything. Well, that was when it was $400. You know, today we're almost $6,000, and people are angry. I'm like, why are you angry? Well, it's down from 20,000. Right, but I wrote in December that at 20,000, that was a stupid price because people are conflating value and price, right? The value of a network, right? How much is one cell phone worth? Nothing.
Yeah.
How about two cell phones? Still nothing. How about 10,000 cell phones? Maybe a little bit. How about 1 million cell phones? Now you're talking.
Yeah.
1 billion cell phones? 10 billion cell phones? That's why Apple's the most, you know, important company in the world right now. Alibaba, you know, right on their heels. But networks matter. And the bigger the network, the more valuable it is. And so when Bitcoin had, you know, 50,000 users, right? It wasn't very valuable, right? It traded single-digit dollars. Today, with 50 million plus users, it's significantly more valuable. And when there's, you know, 5 billion users, which I think there will be someday, as cryptocurrency replaces fiat currency over the long term, why? Because we're going from the analog age to the digital age. Everything that's going on now is just about technology. Technology follows a 14-year cycle. 1954 was the mainframe. 1968 was the microchip. 1982 was the personal computer. 1996 was the internet. 2010 was the mobile net. And 2024, which is still 6 years from now, is the internet of value. And what the internet did for information and commerce. Remember, Paul Krugman said that the internet would never be more valuable than a fax machine.
I was going to bring that up.
Why would anybody need anything other than the Encyclopedia Britannica, which, you know, I used to read the Encyclopedia Britannica for fun back when that's all there was. There was no internet. So
I remember those days.
All the world's, pardon?
I said I remember those days. Yeah,
the good old days.
Yeah,
right? I mean, I was on Capitol Hill watching, you know, the moon landing from my apartment when I was a little boy. So the key is that what people don't realize is this technological wave that's coming is going to take us from the analog age. So for 400 years, we've been trading pieces of paper, right? Stock certificates, bearer bonds, certificates of title for cars and houses. It's paper. There's no reason it should be paper. We're going to move to a fully digital age, and the only way to do that is through the adoption of blockchain technology, which is just distributed ledger technology in an immutable and decentralized application. And why is decentralized so important? Well, a centralized system goes down all the time. How many times have you tried to log onto something or go to a website and they say, oh, we're having technical difficulties, because they're a centralized system. How do you kill a centralized system? All you got to do is kill one hub. A decentralized system, it's like a hydra. You chop off one head and you got six others to deal with. So decentralization is better. It's been coming since 1988, right? This is not a new technology. Tim May wrote the Crypto Anarchist Manifesto in 1988. The Economist magazine had on the cover that we'd have a global currency by 2018. It's happened to be 2018 right now. And they called it the Phoenix. Instead, it's going to be Bitcoin. Now, Bitcoin is just one important thing. And the price, the current price of Bitcoin is insignificant. Just doesn't matter. What matters is that Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, and there's only like a dozen cryptocurrencies. There's a whole bunch of utility tokens that people think are cryptocurrencies. Those are not. Those are utility tokens, and most of them are like Chuck E. Cheese tokens. They really are worthless. But people, it's like early stage venture capital. 90% of the deals go to zero, but the 10% that go up a lot, we remember, right? We all talk about Apple, but we forget about the nine other companies that started in a garage and didn't work. Or we talk about Microsoft as a success. Well, you know, Microsoft almost didn't exist because the IBM guys really wanted to buy CPM technology, which is way better than DOS at the time. But the guys from CPM had put the date of the meeting wrong in their book. And when the guys flew from Seattle, they met with Bill, thought he was the coffee boy. They went down, said, we're not doing it with Microsoft. They went down to California. The couple that invented CPM didn't show up. They said, well, we can't do nothing. So they went back to Seattle and signed the DOS agreement. True story.
Wow, I didn't know that.
So, it's a crazy story. So the key is, I probably have some of my factoids a little bit wrong, but that's exactly what happened, is the CPM guys made a mistake. My first box in college was a CPM box, and it didn't crash every couple of days. I'd have to turn it off and restart it. But the key is, it's a long ramble to say, this is about technology. It's about ownership of the network. And you want to own networks early, and you don't want to look at the price. Think about this. How many people do you know, and you should know at least some, who bought Amazon in 1998 on the IPO and have never sold it?
Yeah, I believe
it's almost zero. There's almost zero, right? There's a couple, but almost zero. Now, why didn't they do that? That's because every year since Amazon's been public, it's had a double-digit drawdown. The average peak-to-trough drawdown has been 31%, and three times it's fallen more than 90%.
Wow, three times.
Three times. So people never stick with it, because when it's down 90%, what do? You sell, and you don't buy it back because you're ruined. And that's what's happening with Bitcoin right now. People who bought at 20,000 are selling now at 6,000, and they're not going to buy back. And that would be foolish. But let's not talk about crypto. Let's talk about blockchain. Let's talk about the innovation wave that's going to happen. Every asset of value in the world is going to be tokenized. Every stock, every bond, every piece of real estate, every car title, every property title, it's all going to be digital tokens. We're going to get rid of paper shares. We're going to go to a fully digital world, and we're going to have fractional ownership potential of every asset in the world. Let's take the Plaza Hotel in New York, iconic piece of real estate. How many buyers are there in the world for the Plaza Hotel? 500? 600?
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. Pick a number. You got to have $600 million handy to buy it. But how many people are there around the world who would like to own a fractional piece of the iconic Plaza Hotel?
Oh, man.
A million?
Yeah.
10 million? 100 million? A billion? It's a big number. So what's going to happen is the value of that asset goes up. We've been contacted by a professional sports team to help them tokenize their team. How much would your listeners pay to own a fractional share of the Seahawks?
Oh.
I bet it's more than the current value.
Yeah,
right?
And the value would
Everybody
go through the
would
roof.
Love to say, I own a piece of the team. How yep. awesome. And so they could buy a Hawk token, and then they could use those Hawk tokens not only as an ownership value of the team, but they could use Hawk tokens as a utility to pay for tickets, to buy stuff in the stadium, to buy merchandise, to trade with their friends, like trading cards. The utility of tokenizing real-life assets is the biggest technical revolution I've seen in my lifetime, and it's just getting started. And so all this talk about Bitcoin this and Bitcoin that misses the whole point. Cryptocurrencies are store of value, medium of exchange. Utility tokens are just early-stage venture capital. Don't do one, do a whole bunch. Maybe one or two win, but a whole bunch of them are going to zero, and that's okay. But what you really want to focus your time is on security tokens, and that's still yet to come. But think about it. None of your listeners would ever say, I bought Apple paper shares represented by a digital QSIP, electronic QSIP, settled on DTCC, right? They say, I bought Apple.
Right.
In the future, when they say, I bought Apple, it will be a digital token that trades on an exchange rather than a paper security held in DTC trading on NYSE.
Well,
it's a pretty cool.
Yeah, and this is one of the things, I like the fact that you differentiated between the two because, and I got it, since I've got you here, I do want to ask you one more question about Bitcoin.
Sure.
For my own edification, but I don't want to lose it because I've been intrigued by it the whole way along just because of my disdain for what fiat currencies have become. And I believe the trail of disaster that you can take all the way back to 1971.
Yep.
You know, to me, it's an apolitical situation. I don't think everybody will attribute it to going off the gold standard. I'm not sitting there saying we need to go on the gold standard. But any end around that we can get past central banks and fiat currencies to me is extremely intriguing. It's going to be beneficial for people that don't even...
Zach, think about this. You're exactly right. Look, 1971 was an historic day. And again, this is not about politics left or right. This is about plain and simple kleptocracy.
Right.
Okay? The people at the top of every empire, okay, not just America, British Empire, Ottoman Empire, go back in time throughout history, every empire, every banana republic, the way it works is the people at the top gather all the assets. Then they systematically devalue the currency so that their assets go up in value and everybody else loses. What was the best performing stock market last year? Venezuela.
Yeah, right.
Would you like to own Venezuelan stocks? Hell no, because they devalued their currency. You had to own the assets in advance of the devaluation. And think about the second best performing stock market was Zimbabwe. Same thing. Okay, I have $100 trillion Zimbabwe dollar bill on my desk right now. I'm staring at it. Okay, it wouldn't buy a loaf of bread. $100 trillion Zimbabwe dollars would not buy a loaf of bread because the elites systematically devalued the currency. Think about what's going on in the United States. We have the greatest income inequality in the history of America, worse than 1929. Why? Because we are systematically devaluing the currency, right? Coca-Cola, when I was growing up in Seattle, I could buy a Coke at 7-Eleven for 25 cents. It cost me a lot more than 25 cents today. Think about the price of gas that you remember. I remember, again, going to 7-Eleven. Gas was 23 cents in Kirkland, Washington. Okay? Doesn't cost that much today. So what's happening is we're being boiled, again, back to the boil like a frog. We're being boiled like a frog. The wealthy get wealthier because they're the only ones that own the assets. 49% of people in this country don't own one share of stock.
Jeez.
That's a frightening thought.
Yeah.
Okay? That's a frightening thought. That's just crazy. And it's because many people don't have, you know, 401ks. Many people don't have savings. And so a whole bunch of these assets that we talk about every day, day in, day out, aren't really benefiting the average person. It's because in 1971, we cut the cord with gold. We went to fiat currency. And all fiat currency means is that it's unbacked by any real asset. And so it can be created at will with the punch of a button on a computer. And the only way that works is you have to have some backing for it. So we cut a deal with Saudi Arabia, and they agreed to to price every oil transaction in the world in dollars in exchange for us protecting them. Okay, that was the deal.
Yep.
And it's worked great for 40 plus years. The petrodollar system has worked, but now it's crumbling because Russia and China have said, no, we want our currencies to be more important. And so we're going to go off the dollar standard, and we're going to go off the petrodollar standard. And so what you're seeing is this increase in inequality and this transition of wealth from the masses to the few. And that's all because central banks can devalue the currency at the punch of a button. So in 2008, Satoshi-san said, no mas. I'm going to create a bounded currency, meaning a currency with a finite amount that cannot be devalued, and therefore the price of that currency, as more people come into the system, think about it. If there's $100 billion in the system today, divided by 21 million units, you get about $5,500. If there's $8 trillion, which would be roughly the equivalent of gold, then each coin would be worth about $400,000. Instead of the opposite, which happens is you increase the number of dollars at the punch of a button, and you buy treasuries, okay? So you have this illusion of a transaction, even though you're printing one side and buying a real asset from banks, so the banks can be enriched. Again, that's just the elites transferring money to themselves because they own all the banks. So some of the people say, that sounds like a conspiracy theory. It's not conspiratorial at all. It's real. It's happening every single day. We know that the M2 in the United States has grown asymmetrically and asymptotically, exponentially, over the last 25 years. And because of that, the value of a dollar, right, that green piece of paper, I mean, I guess I got, for the first time, I got a $50 bill out of an ATM.
Really?
What's up with that? That's ridiculous. Why? And it's because people have to take more out of the ATM to pay for the same stuff. I don't know if you've seen that picture of the grocery cart. It shows 1980, two grocery carts, then 1990, one grocery
yeah.
cart, then 2000, half a cart, and today it's like two things for $20.
Oh.
So
yeah.
anyway,
no,
that's
you're...
where we are. That's why sound currency, cryptocurrency, I think over time will play a much bigger and important role. And the key today is not to worry about the price of cryptocurrency, but to worry about owning some of it. And I'm talking 1, 2, 3% of your assets, not all of your assets, but a portion of your assets, get them off the grid, get them out of the realm of devaluation by central banks. And the other way to think about it is this, particularly for someone in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, if you take 1% of your assets and you put it in something where the risk is it could go to zero. You lose 1% of your assets, no big deal. But it could go up 30, 40, 50 times. That could make a difference in your life.
Yeah, no.
There have been very few assets in my lifetime with that kind of risk reward. So,
yeah, that
what I like about it.
That convexity built into it. And then the one, is, I'm with you. After looking at the, I was explaining this to some clients because it's one of those things that, you got to bring up gingerly because for obvious reasons, I know you know that, right? You've experienced that. But if you say it amongst the wrong folks, they just attack you on it. And I get it. But the ICO, the security, you know, the security token side of it, I was explaining it to a client the other day. And I said, look, if you step back and think about it, it's just a better mousetrap. We got no intermediaries. You got, you know, infinite in terms of, you know, Bitcoin trades 24/7. You know, you're not dealing with these banks who have, you know, that's a whole nother conversation. But as far as the security tokens goes, it's, you know, one thing I look back through history is whenever you see those moments where there's a better mousetrap, it may take a while for them to catch on. But if it's better in every aspect, which, you know, you bring up the shares trading and the manipulation that can go on with that and all that. The ICOs definitely are an end around on that one. But as Bitcoin in particular goes, the biggest issue I've got is if Bitcoin becomes that currency, then central banks effectively lose control of economies in the way that we're used to them having control now, correct?
Yep.
Wouldn't you agree? Now,
yep.
while
yep.
you and I, while I salivate at that possibility, they're not just going to sit back and watch this happen, are they? Like, that's the
Of course not. Of course not. They're going to fight. Look, China tried to ban cryptocurrencies, and what happened? All the exchanges moved to Japan, and crypto kept trading, and Chinese citizens kept trading. Now, some fewer number, you know, traded in China, but China will be back, and governments will definitely fight. And look, all incumbents in any industry will fight. It's like, it reminds me of the street sweepers in New York. See, most people don't know that in downtown New York, near Stuyvesant Ave, in downtown, you know, old downtown, the stoops on homes are 9 feet above street level, right? There's a walkway up. And people say, well, why is that? Well, it's because horse poop, used to stack up 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 feet high.
Wow.
Now, why was that? Well, it's because they had a lot of horses walking up and down. And you had people who swept horse poop to the side, and that was their job. And so when the horseless carriage came out, they were really angry. And they're like, oh, these things are dangerous. Don't go in one of those. You could die, right? Little they, you know, they didn't quote the fact that more people were trampled to death by horses, et cetera, or crushed by horse-drawn carriages. But that wasn't the point, right? They didn't want you to buy a horseless carriage because then they'd be out of a job, even though it was a lousy job. You know, cleaning up horse poop is not a good job. But those jobs were never coming back. The incumbents were going to get disrupted. The buggy whip manufacturers were put out of business, and everybody complained. Well, then we had a new industry, and people stopped complaining. And now, you know, the internal combustion engine people are all unhappy because of EVs, and, you know, banks are unhappy. You know, Jamie Dimon calls Bitcoin a fraud because he doesn't want to lose his job, right? You know, why do I need a bank? Why do you and I need a bank? If I want to transfer you $20, I can do it with Bitcoin for nothing. I don't need a bank. I don't need to pay a commission. I don't need a trust institution to tell me that it happened. I put it on the blockchain. It's permanent. It's immutable. It's done. Money transferred. So that's coming. It's going to disrupt the banking industry. It's going to disrupt, you know, Western Union. And incumbents are always going to fight back. Governments are going to fight back. Central banks are going to fight back. They like having control. They like being able to enrich the elite. They like staying in power. I would say there's no political parties anymore. There's no left. There's no right. There's just in power and out of power. When you're in power, you do or say whatever it takes to stay in. And when you're out, you do or say whatever it takes to get in. So anyway, I will leave you with that. It's been fun hanging out and talking about everything under the sun and actually weaving in a little Seattle history as well. The only thing we didn't talk about was Jimi Hendrix, but
we'll
do that next time.
And I appreciate the time, Mark. And as always, it's enlightening and insightful. And I hope all the listeners enjoyed it as much as I did. And can't thank you enough for being with us. And we're going to keep an eye on this stuff and try to bug you and get you on again here in the future for updates. So thanks again for joining us.
I'm around. You know where to find me. And if people are looking for me on Twitter, it's at Mark Yusko.
Yes.
And otherwise, you can find me on this channel with Zach and his crew. And we'll talk to you again soon.
All right. You have a great weekend, sir. And thanks for listening. And stick with us. We got more coming after this. But we've been here with Mark Yusko, and we got to run. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.